Hi, welcome back. We're sitting here with Rabbi David Aaron, who's the founder and dean of Israelite, an organization based in the Old City of Jerusalem, where we're actually sitting right now. We actually have the distinct pleasure of sitting in the home of Rabbi Aaron, here overlooking reconstruction of one of the old synagogues here in the Old City. Rabbi Aaron is the founder and dean of Israelite, as we just said. He also is the author of a number of books, six of which are published, and two of which are in the works. Hello, Rabbi Aaron.
Hi.
So we're sitting here because Rabbi Aaron has a new book coming out called...
Living a Joyous Life, The True Spirit of Jewish Practice.
And it's being published by...
Trumpeter, distributed by Random House.
Okay, great. And when's the date of...
It'll be out the beginning of August.
Okay, great. We're going to talk about the book, and maybe other things will come up too. We have a lot of interesting questions, and I'm sure Rabbi Aaron has a lot of interesting answers for us. Okay, so this is, what, the sixth book? Why does the world need another book by Rabbi David Aaron? Hasn't everything been said?
Well, my whole educational direction has been to give people the context that embraces Jewish life and work from the all-embracing context towards the details of Jewish life. So my other books deal with the general philosophical, mystical principles of Jewish life. And now I'm folding those ideas into the daily practice. Who is God? What is Torah? Why study Torah? Why live the mitzvot? Why celebrate Shabbat? Why eat kosher? Why pray? It's about finding joy in the daily Jewish life. I call it from moving from the oy to the joy of being Jewish.
Okay, so how about for someone who, let's say, isn't keeping kosher, isn't learning Torah, why would they buy your book?
Well, it's hard to really love being Jewish if you don't understand what Jewish life is really all about. My hopes for this book is that Jews will have now an opportunity to re-explore themselves as Jews from a mature, sophisticated, spiritual point of view and be able to understand better what is all this Jewish stuff all about.
When I was looking at the contents of the book, the first chapter is called Unpacking Jewish Baggage. How does that fit into re-exploring Judaism or the mitzvot?
Right. Unpacking Jewish Baggage is a little bit about my own personal life, which I share quite honestly with people. I did not grow up in a home that had much Torah or much Jewish life in it, but it was a home that had a lot of Jewish feeling in it. My father came from Russia, so he has a nice Jewish accent, Yiddish accent. My mother was a survivor of the Holocaust, and that plays very much into who I am. A real strong sense that the Jewish people for many years were dealt very cruelly and murdered in the most horrible ways. And so I kind of grew up not with a very happy, light orientation or identification with being Jewish. Being Jewish meant for me pain, suffering. It meant being isolated by the world. And I was sure that I'd probably stay Jewish, but only out of guilt, but not out of joy. And so that first chapter of Unpacking Jewish Baggage is about the Jewish baggage that most Jews I've met actually have with their Jewish life, and I think it is that baggage that is so heavy that they can't take a spiritual journey about being Jewish.
Okay, so not to give away any of the secrets in the book, but what is the process the person would go through to unpack their Jewish baggage?
Well, the first step is to really get in touch with what you think you know about Judaism. For instance, one of the workshops that we do at Israelite is I do like a word association where I ask people to just freely associate with whatever word I'm about to say or words I'm about to say. So I say, God, childhood, what comes to mind? And at one particular event, I remember a woman immediately shot up her hand and said, I can't believe this. I don't think I thought of this since it happened. I must have been maybe 7 or 8 years old. I don't know what I did wrong, but I must have done something really wrong because I remember my mother screaming, God's going to punish you! God's going to punish you! And of course, in the name of God, as I guess his agent, my mother's going to hit me. So running from my mother, I ran into the bathroom and I locked the door. My mother starts banging on the door. come out, you bad girl, because God's going to punish you. Come out, bad girl, God's going to punish you. To that, I called out. I said, well, he can't get me here because I'm in the bathroom. And to that, her mother said, oh, you silly child, God is everywhere, even in the bathroom. Now imagine what goes through the mind of a little girl who thinks that God is so mean that he goes after little girls in the toilet. I mean, like, there's no place that you are safe from this mean, angry God who's so punishing. Well, when this girl shared this story, everyone in the room kind of went, whoa, like, that was a pretty intense story. She just thought, oh yeah, I haven't thought of that since I'm a child. But after I heard her share that story, I then was able to understand why this woman was an atheist. And I was happy that she was an atheist. Because anybody who believes in a God who is so mean that he chases after little girls in the bathroom, that's not good. They'd be healthier not believing in God than believing in such a horrible God. So that's just one kind of baggage. Obviously, I think that's extraordinary. I hope that most people don't have that much of a negative kind of orientation to God. But I've met enough people that seem to have even that much baggage. But even less than that, I know that when I was growing up, I had a very clear picture of what a practicing Jew was. That picture was hanging on the wall of our living room. It was a picture my parents bought, probably in the Arab market in Jerusalem. It was a picture of old rabbis. And they were sitting in this gloomy, dark, depressing room. Three of them, they had long white beards and thick glasses, and they had these volumes of books stacked up on the table. And one looked like an umpire saying, "You're out!" The other one had this face of, "Oy vey!" And the other one had, "Ah!" And I did not see myself in that picture. I never wanted to be in a picture. For me, if that's what living a Jewish life is, a Torah life is, that the goal is to be all decrepitated in some gloomy, dark, depressing room, sitting there discussing minutiae of Jewish law that has no relevance to my life, I didn't want to be in that picture. I didn't realize what an impact that picture had on me growing up, but that was a picture I had. I thought that a Torah sage had to be old. But the sad thing is that what most people don't appreciate is in the Torah and Jewish tradition, when we say a tzaddik, a holy person, one of the archetypical characters that symbolize that great holy person is Joseph. Now, I don't think anybody, when you hear the word Joseph, imagines an old man. I think we imagine a young, playful, very colorful fellow with this rainbow, funky kind of, coat. And the oral tradition teaches that he was so beautiful that girls would actually climb walls to take a look at him. He was charismatic. He became essentially the functioning king of Egypt of the time. And he was decked out in the finest Egyptian clothing. He was a man that had both the stature of being a politician, and yet he also was a man who had a great and profound sense of God's presence in his daily life. That's an image of a Torah Jew that I could get into and I could admire and perhaps even see myself want to be. But I don't think anybody looks forward to being old and pale and hunched over in some gloomy room. But the sad thing is that most Jews don't understand the vitality of Jewish living. They don't understand why they should celebrate Judaism. They think that it is just about guilt. It's about, come on kids, pack your bags, we're going on a guilt trip. And my point is, okay, let's unpack our bags and take a spiritual journey.
Okay, now for adults this makes sense. The book obviously will be appealing. How about for kids who are in Hebrew school or kids who are in, let's say, yeshiva day schools, or young people, even kids who are entering their bar mitzvah? How will this book connect with them?
Well, thank God my books have an unusual quality of, on one hand, offering very deep ideas, but in a very simple language that anyone can really appreciate. I can't say that the books were specifically written for 13-year-olds or 14-year-olds, but I do believe that if you have a 13 or 14-year-old who is sophisticated, who's a mature thinker, and I've met plenty of kids like that today, they will enjoy the book because even if they haven't yet developed their baggage with Judaism, although, quite frankly, by the time I was 13, I had tons of baggage that could have filled an airport. My guess is lots of kids have a lot of stuff with God, with Judaism, with commandments, and with rabbis. I think it will have tremendous worth for a younger crowd too, although it really is written for more of an adult mind.
Can you give us an example of one of the, let's say, since we spoke about learning Torah, maybe a little snippet from the book about the value or the joyousness of learning Torah?
Right. You know, I recall when I was in high school, we would study these textbooks, and I had really no clue, neither did my friends have any clue of who wrote these textbooks. And it really didn't matter who wrote these textbooks, although we did know who published them. It was always someone with the name Mick. It was always Mick Master, Mick Millen, Mick Mouse, whoever it was. Someone had published these textbooks. We happened to notice who published them, but we never really knew who wrote them, nor did we really care, nor was ever important, nor were we ever even asked on any exams. The point was, get the information, cram it into your head, and then, sadly enough, I know for myself, and I think most of my friends, after the exam, we forget most of it, if not almost all of it. I mean, till today, although I studied many, many years of French, at this point I can recall about 5 words of French. Unfortunately, a lot of education is about cramming information that often is not so relevant, and very often we forget as soon as the pressure of the exam or the test is over. When we are learning Torah, Torah has a claim. Whether a person accepts that claim or not, that's not the first step. The first step is to appreciate what this book claims about itself. This book claims to be Eitz HaChayim. It claims to be the book of life. And that everything in this book is going to address everything you need to live the fullest, most fulfilling, most whole life that one could ever imagine. Now again, that's not at all what I thought of when I was in Hebrew school. I was forced to go to Hebrew school for 2 hours a day growing up, and although I hated Hebrew school, I have to admit that it gave me a certain sense of God, because every day, sitting there bored, I would pray to God, please God, you took the Jewish people out of Egypt, surely you could perform the same miracle and take me out of Hebrew school. But essentially, when I studied Torah in Hebrew school, it didn't in any way touch me. It didn't feel relevant. It didn't speak to me, nor did I feel it was going to empower me to get somewhere in my life. That's so sad, and I'm so thankful that at a later date in my life, when I was 18, I had the opportunity to re-explore the text of Torah and discover how these stories in the Bible are not just stories, but they're actually archetypes of the basic predicaments that all human beings will and do find themselves in, giving us very real guidance in how to navigate our lives and achieve real happiness, a real sense of meaning and purpose and passion.
This book is not your first book. There's a bunch of the others that came before, and they have already a pretty well-deserved good reputation.
Yeah, thank God.
Can you just tell us a little bit about Endless Light, the first book, and about the impact that had? And then
sure,
we'll...
thank you. My first book is titled Endless Light, the Ancient Path of Kabbalah to Love, Spiritual Growth, and Personal Power. And that's really, really what it's about. I am I'm drawing from the Kabbalistic tradition the very essential lessons on how does one really achieve love, how to express love, how to accept love, how to find my real self, how to really tap the true meaning of self-worth and real empowerment so that I can get to where I really want to go in my life. My second book, Seeing God, 10 Life-Changing Lessons from the Kabbalah, is an experiential guide that really brings you to truly see God. Now, not if you think God is some being floating in outer space. Such a God you won't see, because such a God doesn't exist. But when you really follow the teachings of Judaism as clarified for us through the teachings of Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, we are actually able to see God in our lives. And recently I met a fellow at one of my talks, a large event in Milwaukee. A fellow came up to me in his mid-40s and said, you know, you don't know me, but you have completely changed my life. I've been an ardent atheist my entire life. Someone suggested I read your book, Seeing God, and after that book, I immediately became a believer, and it has dramatically changed my life. So I'm very thankful that I have received a tremendous amount of feedback on both those books, how they have really, really touched and transformed people.
Now, how about The Secret Life of God?
My third book is called The Secret Life of God, Discovering the Divine Within You. It's really about who are we, why are we, and what can we become. In that book, I draw once again from the Kabbalistic commentary on the Torah to enable us to understand, why is this world so imperfect? Why did a perfect God create an imperfect world, an imperfect me, and put me into this world, right? I once heard a cute joke. They say, practice makes perfect, but nobody's perfect, so I stopped practicing. The truth is that nobody's perfect, and that's what's perfect about you. What the secret life of God enables people to do is to celebrate the imperfection as an opportunity for a life of dynamic growth. I'm very excited about the fact that this book has become very popular amongst therapists, not for themselves only, but as recommended reading for therapy for their clients. In fact, there is a therapist in Boston who has become so enthralled with the message and the principles, the Kabbalistic principles in the Secret Life of God, that now he has all of his clients. He sees 40 clients a week, which does not exhaust how many clients he actually has. And he is reporting significant breakthroughs in the mental health and the real healing. In fact, he wrote an article called My Patient Was Cured by a Book. And that article is actually available on the website of Israelite. And he really goes through the three basic syndromes that people are really struggling with and that are truly oppressed by in their lives, and how the secret life of God is addressing these fundamental needs. I actually also received an article written by one of his clients on how the secret life of God actually changed her life and empowered her to deal with some very long life issues that she had till that point not been able to get a handle on and really move forward with.
So I have a question. Speaking of this, it seems interesting that only maybe within the last five years, especially the last few years, it seems like people are starting to discover the healing power of Kabbalah, and not in a flaky way, but in a really practical way. What do you have to say about that?
Well, the Kabbalah actually does prophetically tell us that this is the age whereby the upper wisdom of the world will open up and the lower wisdom will open up. And through the lower wisdom, we will access the higher wisdom. The Kabbalah teaches that the higher wisdom is the teachings of Kabbalah, which once again reveal, Kabbalah is not an independent religion. Kabbalah reveals the secret code at the very core of the Torah of Jewish life, of the wisdom of Judaism. And the lower wisdom is the sciences, and that we are now positioned in our generation with the various scientific discoveries and models to finally understand what the Kabbalists were actually talking about long ago. And now those Kabbalistic principles are a lot more accessible, and we are a lot more able to utilize those principles to live a happier, more fulfilling life.
So does that mean the Kabbalistic principles actually underlie the sciences as well?
Absolutely, yes. The Kabbalistic principles are the grammar of life. Imagine you were to pick up a book and you look at a page, and although you know the meaning of the individual words, but you don't know any grammatical principles. So even though you know what each word means, it's the unwritten grammatical principles that tie those words together into sentences, paragraphs, and chapters. And that's really what the Kabbalah is in relationship to the rest of Jewish wisdom. The Kabbalah is the unwritten grammatical rules, spiritual grammatical rules that enable us to see how the lifestyle of Judaism comes together into a whole technology of spiritual growth.
You mentioned before that your first few books are about the general principles, and then you get more into details. So the most recent book before this one, Inviting God In, about the holidays, how does that fit in to stepping from the general into the more specific?
Well, once we move from the general context of who is God, who are we, why are we, and where is it all going, and a more general appreciation of what Judaism's purpose is all about, we now fold that into and utilize that to begin to examine daily Jewish life. Part of the daily Jewish life that a lot of Jews are still positive about are holidays, right? In fact, there's a cute joke by Henny Youngman that said, you know, I tried being an atheist, but I gave it up. There weren't any holidays. So holidays are really good, and a lot of Jews actually still have a positive feeling for Hanukkah, Purim. I understand in college dorms, Purim is practiced actually every weekend. It's a mitzvah to get drunk on Purim. But other than that, you know, Passover, there's still a positive feeling, I think, a lot of Jews have about Judaism. So let's start where Jews still feel good about themselves, and so that's why we decided to publish Inviting God In, a book about the spiritual. It's actually called Inviting God In, the Soul Meaning of the Jewish Holidays. And thank God that book is doing fabulously well. We decided that we need to offer people an understanding of those aspects of Judaism that might not be as popular, you know, in terms of eating kosher and in terms of the celebration of the Shabbat as well as living mitzvahs. Many Jews believe that living a Jewish life is restrictive, and that basically it may be God had a fetish in some way that everything fun is forbidden. And what this new book, Living a Joyous Life, demonstrate that living a Jewish life is a joyous life, and that what apparently seems to be restrictive is actually a technology that's empowering me to move from a life that's egocentric to a life that is soulful, and to a life that is passionate and powerful.
So Rabbi Aaron, it's well known in the world that you did spend some time in Hollywood with various celebrities, actors, producers, learning Torah with them. What sort of new insights did you gain from that experience versus, let's say, just your normal teaching in Jerusalem experience?
Well, what was very validating and exciting to see is that no matter who you are, no matter how successful you might be, souls have the same questions. Everybody wants to know, who am I? Why am I? What am I doing on planet Earth? What is the genuine way to truly feel good about myself and experience and demonstrate true self-worth? And that the fundamental questions are in fact the questions that all human beings have. It seems to be old hat, it seems to be obvious, and why should we need to know this, that money doesn't buy happiness? And there's a lot of people who have good reasons to be happy or not happy, and a lot of people that have good reasons not to be happy or very happy, and that it really boils down to your beliefs about yourself, about your relationship to the rest of mankind, and your relationship to whoever is beyond all that, which we refer to as God.
Does that give you a certain clarity or a certain purpose in teaching your material with more passion, or did it help you get to a deeper place?
It reinforced my feeling on the serious and desperate need that the world has for clarity and understanding of themselves and the real meaning of life. For some reason, you know, when it comes to driving, you got to get yourself a license. But when it comes to living your life, nobody seems to think that they have to get a license. Having a marriage, you got to get a licensed marriage. But it boggles my mind how much time people invest to really understand how to use their computer. because God forbid if they push the wrong button, they might delete their some of its files or some of its memory or maybe all of its memory. But when it comes to taking care of ourselves, have we really taken the time to understand life and find out how to operate it? Is there a manual that comes with this incredible machine or machinery called life? I was recently speaking to a friend who had kindly lent me his car, and he was giving me this big lecture on being sure exactly how to take care of it and what gas I should put into it. And yet while he's giving me this lecture on taking such good care of his car, this fellow himself lives a very destructive lifestyle based on a diet of complete junk food and smoking and drinking. And it just boggles my mind how a person could care more about their car than their own lives. And I think possibly it comes from a place of just despair that I know how to take care of my car, but I really don't know how to take care of my life. Or it comes from a place that I really don't value my life as much as my car. When a person has the opportunity to study Jewish wisdom and to really explore the guidance that Torah offers us, they will discover how so valuable they are. And they would not treat themselves less than a masterpiece, because every soul is a masterpiece, a piece of the master. Jewish tradition teaches us that the soul is a ray of God, so to speak, an aspect of God. And if God were the sun, we would be a ray of his light. And all that vitality and all that warmth and all that brilliance that's within us is not coming from us. And when I appreciate that incredible connection of myself to the ultimate, I refer to God as the ultimate. You've got your soulmate and you've got your ultimate. When a person is able to really nourish and really deeply connect to that truth, they have plugged their life into endless voltage.
Okay, so I have a little bit of a problem, because obviously you seem like a joyous person, and I've seen some religious Jews who are joyous. But if you're claiming that this book, your book, Living a Joyous Life, is that Judaism is a joyous life, how come there are a lot of Jews who don't seem like they're living a real joyous life?
Well, maybe they will after they read the book. Yeah, that is something that deeply disturbs me also. The Torah actually acknowledges that its teachings can either be an elixir of life or poison. And how's that possible? How could the same book, the same teachings for some people be life-giving, bringing such vitality and zest, and another reading the same book, those teachings actually is poisonous? It has to do with the hard drive. You know, there's the computer and there's the software and then there's the hard drive, and the hardware is what reads the software. You can't just pick up the Bible and read it and think you're going to plug it in and pull up the files that really speak to you. There is an orientation that one must have that is essential so that they're reading the Torah with the right eyes. And therefore, you can have a person that meticulously practices everything written in the Torah, but because their overall orientation to themselves and their relationship to God is off, that undermines what they're doing. In other words, Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook, one of the great sages of the last generation, he explains that there are heretics that are actually the deepest believers, and there are believers that are actually heretics. Now, how could that be? What is he talking about? He's saying that there are people who say they don't believe in God, but they're really saying that because of their deep understanding of who God is. And therefore, they unfortunately have been taught an image of God that is so childish and so destructive that they can't believe in that God. The Lubavitcher Rebbe used to say to atheists, the God you don't believe in, I don't believe in either. So a person, you might have a person who actually says they don't believe in God, but the reason why they don't believe in God is because their soul is demanding a higher faith, a more clear and more sophisticated understanding of God, since they never received that. So they're left with some silly, childish image of God, which they are denouncing, and rightfully so. But then you could have a person who says they believe in God, But they believe in some being that floats in outer space, who's angry, who's out to get them. There's a cute comic strip of Calvin and Hobbes, where Hobbes turns to Calvin and says, Calvin, do you believe in God? And Calvin says, well, somebody's out to get me. And so you can have a person that believes in a God who's out to get you and completely submits themselves to that angry God. But the truth is that that is heresy. The God they believe in is a spiritual idol, a mental idol. It is possible that people can read the Torah with the wrong eyes, and that's why it's so important to have the general principles and a clear understanding of the ultimate ideals of Judaism, the context of Judaism, and then fold that context into the details. A person who has not read my other books will still gain tremendous amount from these two books on the holidays and daily Jewish practice, because what I do is I clarify those details of Jewish life, but in the light of the general principles.
Okay, so the book is Living a Joyous Life, The True Spirit of Jewish Practice, published by Trumpeter Books, available in August. Thank you very much, Rabbi Aaron, for your time.
Thank you.
Speaking about the book, and we'll see you soon.
Okay, blessings.